The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, May 5th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kim Kelly, author of Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. And later in the show, Jessica Cisneros is back, progressive candidate running in Texas's 28th district, here to respond to the Roe v. Wade news, because her opponent is anti-abortion in a Democratic runoff. Meanwhile, with Roe v. Wade likely being overturned in a few weeks, reports say the Biden administration is, quote, scrambling for a solution. Who could have seen this coming? Abortion pills, though, through the mail after a telehealth visit with a doctor could be a solution. But Republican governors and lawmakers in states are already moving to close that loophole, too. The federal government's got to find a workaround here. Maybe you can pick them up on federal property, something like that. At the same time, blue states like Rhode Island and California are moving to strengthen abortion protections. Rhode Island just upheld a law that protected abortion, while Gavin Newsom is proposing an amendment to protect the right in the California Constitution. The U.S. has officially surpassed 1 million COVID deaths, according to NBC News, 27 months after the first case of the virus cropped up here. 1 million. The Fed raises interest rates by half a point in an attempt to combat inflation, and the stock market responded accordingly, having its best day since 2020. Woohoo! We could just tax the rich, too, but... In Ukraine, the Associated Press estimates that 600 died in the airstrike on the theater in Mariupol, where Ukrainians were sheltering. The bloodshed continues. And a new study by the Trans Youth Project finds that only 2.5% of the children in their study decided to revert back to their assigned gender after living as their chosen gender for 5 years. That is what we call overwhelming data. And lastly, texts revealed in the January 6th committee investigation show Donald Trump Jr., who appeared before the committee yesterday, pleading with Mark Meadows to get his father to stop the riot. Quote, he has to lead now, he wrote. And that is like praying for rain in a desert. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a tough news week so far, but, you know, we're still plugging along. Here I am with Matt and Bradley holding down the fort. Say hello, friends.
Hey.
Hey.
Hello.
Yeah. We'll talk more about abortion, Roe v. Wade, a little bit later in the program, and particularly with Jessica Cisneros, because Henry Cuellar, her opponent, the incumbent, is still getting support from the number three House Democrat, Jim Clyburn, campaigning with him, despite his anti-abortion stance.
Yeah, on the one hand, he's the last anti-abortion or super anti-abortion Democrat in the House. On the other hand, he's super corrupt. And so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's the FBI raid. I don't know. That might have been another area of concern besides the anti-abortion stuff.
This whole we protect all of our incumbents. Sometimes you got to cut bait.
Yep. This would be one of those instances, but Clyburn, stubborn as hell on this. We'll ask Jessica Cisneros a little bit more about that later in the show. But let's turn to some of the labor organizing efforts, because that will be the theme, really, of what we're talking about today with Kim Kelly. Yesterday, Sam headlined this, but I think it's important to talk a bit more about it. Starbucks announced on Tuesday that they're going to increase wages. Woohoo! Right? That's a great position, except it's not. Because they are only going to increase wages, according to Howard Schultz on the call with investors, for non-unionized stores. This is a way to try to union bust, try to work around the law in order to do so. Starbucks announced Tuesday it was raising pay and expanding training at corporate-owned locations in the United States, but it said the changes would not apply to the recently unionized stores, or to stores that may be in the process of unionizing, such as those where workers have filed a petition for a union election. On a call with investors to discuss the company's quarterly earnings, the chief executive, Howard Schultz, said that the spending would bring investments in workers and stores to nearly $1 billion for the fiscal year, and that it would help Starbucks keep up with customer traffic. The Starbucks union filed a formal charge with the NLRB because this is pretty brazen.
Well, you think about the logic of it, right? Like the thing that bosses aren't supposed to be able to do, which is to threaten your job or like wages if you unionize. This is sort of like an implicit one of those, right?
Yeah.
Like it's just to put the put it before the cart before the horse, basically. Like, first of all, good for all those Starbucks workers who are going to get the wage increase, but thank the unionized workers and know that there's a lot more where that came from, and to continue the tactic that got you this, which is unionizing.
Well, who knows if this even stands, because again, this is, it's dancing, it should be entirely illegal, but it's dancing on that line at the very least. They're terrified because over 50 Starbucks stores have voted to unionize. Elections have been successful in 54 out of the 60 elections. And so the NLRB is essentially going to file a formal complaint here because they're accusing the company of, quote, coercing employees who are voting in the union election by suggesting that it would withhold new benefits if they unionized.
Yep.
That is the actual reality of it. They're just flipping the language to make it seem like a positive when in reality they're discriminating against unionizing employees, and that's illegal. Hopefully they're held to account. But in other union news, right now, testifying in front of the Senate Budget Committee, Chris Smalls of the ALU is speaking with senators right now. Even Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham had some words here. We don't have the clip, but this is happening in real time.
But we got the audio here. This is an effort to get an outcome you want using the U.S. Senate as your vehicle. That's your political bias.
Yes, that's him talking. That's Lindsey Graham. Thank you for pulling up that article. I mean, that audio as quickly as possible, Matt. Great production. That's Lindsey Graham speaking to Bernie Sanders, saying that he's going in a, quote, dangerous direction by supporting unions.
And dangerously based, I would say.
Yeah. And Chris Smalls had a reaction to that and addressed Lindsey Graham directly.
Thank you for having me. First of all, I want to address Mr. Graham. It sounded like he was talking about more of the companies and the businesses in your speech, but you forgot that the people are the ones who make these companies operate. And if we're not protected, and if the process for when we hold these companies accountable is not working for us, then that's the reason why we're here today. That's the reason why I'm here, to represent the workers who make these companies go. And I think that it's in your best interest to realize that it's not a left or right thing. It's not a Democrat or a Republican thing. It's a workers thing. It's a workers issue. And we're the ones that are suffering, and the corporations that you're talking about, and the businesses that you're talking about, and the warehouses that you're talking about. So that's the reason why I think I was invited today to speak on that behalf. And you should listen, because we do represent your constituents as well.
We got more, but that was,
that was the crux of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, yes, the ALU does represent his constituents. But Lindsey Graham has another constituency, and that is that of the corporations that donate to his political campaign, and that is of capitalists. So Chris Smalls is right to call him out, and it is about workers. Lindsey Graham made it pretty clear where he stands.
I mean, that's like the key point that people need to start thinking about is like, what do you care about when you care about Starbucks? Like, what's your interaction with even a Starbucks worker? Is you get you like the barista, it's not the executive, for instance, like that. Like, those are the people who have to deal with everything in the store. It's the same thing with these Amazon workers. It's like, who's moving the large, heavy things that are having to get a whip around the country in 2 days? It's not Howard Schultz.
No.
Right.
Right. I mean, and I'm just amazed, one, at the, I'm not amazed by it, but it, or shocked by it. I am still amazed by the arrogance of the executives at Amazon who discounted Chris Smalls' leadership and prowess there and called him literally inarticulate. Like,
you talk about incompetence. I mean, talk about a missed call. That is like, I mean, he's proven himself as like, generational talent as far as doing this.
Oh, yeah.
Like, nailing it there. Able to meet any moment, and they were apparently who the Amazon executives wanted as an opponent.
There's nothing more indicative of the disconnect between corporate management and the workers at Amazon than their characterization of Chris Smalls' ability to lead them. That goes to show how they underestimated him to such a degree that, I mean, it's poetic, it's a hero's story, and look, we're going to talk more about this with Kim Kelly in a bit, but this is one of the few things that gives me hope right now. It's good to see Chris Smalls and labor organizers getting the focus that they deserve right now. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Kim Kelly. We are back, and we are joined, I'm very happy to be joined, by Kim Kelly, journalist, organizer, and author of Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
I had flagged this book maybe like months before it finally came out, and it's come out. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's the wildest thing in the world. I can't believe they let me get away with this, but it's out there.
All right. Well, just don't tell anybody. It's working out right now. I mean, and it couldn't be coming out at a more perfect time. You open your book talking about your reporting on Bessemer, the Amazon organizing effort there, which ended up being unsuccessful. But now we're seeing right now Chris Smalls is testifying to the Senate Budget Committee. Just from your perspective and your reporting on this, what's that like to see these gains even in such a short period of time?
It's incredible. I mean, this is such a historic moment we're all living through. And to have this book come out now, after starting it while I was going back and forth to Alabama, watching these workers in Bessemer try like so hard to organize a union to win against Amazon. You know, it's funny. I spoke to one Amazon labor union organizers the other day when I was in New York, and she's like, yeah, we're reading your book, but like, we're not really in it. What's up? Like, well, I was paying attention to Alabama. Everyone else was paying attention to you guys. And now everyone's paying attention to you guys. And it's just, it's wild. And I hope that folks will pick up this book and take some lessons from the past, some inspiration, because like as historic as this moment is, we've been here before. And there's a lot of lessons we can learn from past organizers and past struggles and past victories.
And that's why your book is just, it's so well-timed. And it also, the focus of it is so key to me because there's this mythology about the union worker in the United States being, you're only a union worker if you have grease on your face and you're a white guy. And those are the kinds of voters that each party needs to appeal to. And the working class is not that, right? I mean, of course, yes, it does include white people, but it also is multi-ethnic, multi-gendered, you know, multi-racial, et cetera, multicultural. And so your focus in your book is really about those different stories. How conscious of a choice was that of yours in order to kind of combat some of that, frankly, fetishization of a very particular kind of worker?
That was the whole point. Okay. Like, that was the book I wanted to write because that's the book I've always wanted to read as someone who's interested in history, as someone who's over the past few years morphed into a labor reporter. Like those are the stories that always stood out to me. And even back when I started covering labor for Teen Vogue, like probably 4 or 5 years ago, those are the stories that I was trying to uncover as much as I could, you know, building on the research and work of historians and archivists and people who have already tread these paths before. And it just because, like, I'm from a union family. My dad is that guy with grease, with the hard hat, with the mostly bad politics. Like, and I knew the union was for people like him, but it wasn't until I joined one myself when we organized at Vice when I was working there as the heavy metal editor in 2015 that I realized, like, oh, wow, unions are really for everyone. Like, if I'm writing about heavy metal on the internet, there's a union for me, then that means, like, anybody qualifies. And it turns out throughout our history, the folks who have been kind of left out or written out or pushed to the side because of who they are, where they come from, the work they do, like they've put in the most work. Like we're here because of them. And it was such a wonderful opportunity to kind of dig into that, you know, I won't say hidden, but maybe less accessible history and kind of bring it to light and put it out there and like put it in Barnes and Nobles and show people that, you know, whoever you are, whatever it is you do, this history belongs to you too. And you probably need a union.
Yeah, well, I do want to get into the history, but you mentioned your work unionizing at Vice. Can you talk about how that helped inspire you to write this book and really what your experience was in doing that?
Sure. It's kind of funny to think back now because it's so common for there to be unions in digital media now. But we were the second. We're right after Gawker. So shout out to Hamilton Nolan. But we organized in, I think, early 2015, right after I got officially hired. I was permalanced before that, doing contract work for like 8 months. We were all, this is an era of Vice where nobody was making any money except the people at the top and the managers. It was just a really difficult place to work. And when we organized, it felt like, okay, we can actually do something about this. And we did. You know, we won these massive gains in our contracts. We won big raises. We won a diversity committee. We won like Gold Star Trans Healthcare for some of our coworkers. Like we were able to make material, real change for our lives and our coworkers' lives. And I was there. I was lucky to be there long enough to bargain 2 separate contracts and organize. I think we got about almost 600 people in the building by the time I got laid off. And that was just the most transformative experience for me because I saw, you know, I'm not just one person. I'm part of something bigger and I can make these changes if I work together with people. And I'd spent most of my life in the music industry up until then writing about heavy metal and putting on shows and touring. And it's kind of a, you know, a solitary career path in a way. Like you gotta figure it out. There's not a lot of money out there. You gotta make it work. But being part of something bigger and then realizing throughout that process of, you know, just what goes into labor law, what goes into organizing, what goes into bargaining, all these different pieces that I'd known about sort of just from being a little bit of a history nerd, seeing it all happen in real life and realizing that, oh, okay, since I've gone through this now and I have a deeper understanding of this, I'm allowed to write about this. I do have some credibility here. I can try it. And Teen Vogue gave me a shot and it turns out I am pretty okay at helping tell worker stories. And it changed my life in the best possible way.
Yeah, I mean, you're great. And there is the fact that you're able to interweave both stories in the present, and that's what your writing is, but also these incredible stories from the past, it paints this amazing picture, and an inspiring one. Let's I guess start with the first factory strike in 1812 1824 that you write about. This was a really interesting place to start.
Yeah, because I mean, it's again, like you said earlier, the idea of labor kind of belonging to the white guys in the hard hats and the white guys in the suits. So many of the firsts, like the most important initial shots across the bow, were made by women and people of color and folks that don't fit that description. I mean, the first factory strike in American history was led by young women in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, who were working in these, you know, these dark satanic mills, these horrible mills, breathing in dust and being paid nothing, being kept in these weird dormitories, just treated like they weren't people, which is something that is a big through line in the history of American labor and America in general. So I thought it was really, I wanted to start with a couple early examples of what resistance looked like, what labor organizing looked like before we had these union, like established unions, before we had union federations, before we had labor laws. And I love that I could put them in there because even at that point, there was this idea that women were supposed to stay home, like they were demure, they couldn't handle heavy labor. Meanwhile, these women and girls, because some of them were girls, were slaving away in these horrible factories, and at one point said, you know what, like we deserve better, we're going to do something about this. And they did. And they were the first in that specific type of action, but they were certainly not the last.
And what was also fascinating and instructive for today was these mill girls, as you write about, how capitalists really saw them as easy targets for exploitive labor practices. Girls and women, they're going to be more subservient to us. It's easier to keep wages down because they will leave the mill in a few years and get married, so there's not that seniority or anything like that. These are practices that remain prevalent to this day in terms of the ways that bosses try to hold on to capital and keep workers away from more wages, better wages.
Yeah. Even that specific, and there's so many examples of that, of bosses making assumptions about certain groups of workers because of who they are. Even speaking about women, I mean, there's a section in the book where I write about flight attendants and they're organizing what they've gone through. And they had that same mindset, like up until pretty recently, that, oh, flight attendants, like they have to be young, they have to fit a specific physical profile, they can't be pregnant, they're going to leave anyway. So we don't need to treat them like workers. We don't need to give them benefits. We don't need to respect them. They're just going to go get married. And obviously it was those workers organizing and fighting against that that has made it a better environment for those workers. Or even going back to the 60s, you know, talking about docile workers during the 60s, when black workers were, you know, becoming much more radicalized and organizing and like holding wildcat strikes and really holding bosses' feet to the fire in Detroit, when bosses started hiring Arab workers, they thought, oh, these guys won't put up much of a fight because, you know, they have a different language, they're isolated, they won't, you know, join with the other workers, we can keep them isolated. And that's not what happened. The Arab workers and the black workers came together and found common ground and found solidarity. And that's how they got their gains. That's how they made things happen. Like, it's been such a major through line this whole time. Bosses think that our differences can be used as a weapon against us. But those of, you know, workers who, you know, are smart and who are resistant to that have been able to find common ground and find common cause. And that's how we win. I think that's a good lesson to take forward, too, especially post-Amazon labor union's first win.
100%. And the constant seeking out, even if it's not explicit, of groups that the bosses perceive as more desperate and or more subservient because of said desperation is also a through line throughout history. And you talk a bit about how the mill conditions start to become more common knowledge. People are understanding how terrible those conditions are. And so that's when they start hiring immigrants.
yeah, that's, again, classic case. Because they realize, oh, people are upset that these nice white Yankee girls are being treated poorly, so let's bring in Irish immigrants, let's bring in Italian immigrants, let's bring in Canadian immigrants, anybody we can get our hands on who are a little bit more desperate, who don't have perhaps a father that we respect at home, you know, and try to grind them down and try to keep them separated by cultural linguistic differences. And that eventually stopped working too. There's a, even if bosses are able to pull that, I don't want to curse, pull that stuff in the beginning of a campaign or the beginning of a new era, it doesn't last because, like, the working class has nothing in common with the employer class. And eventually, when people catch on to that and they realize they're stronger together, that's when stuff gets done.
Right. And so then you move towards, we're moving throughout the 19th century, slavery, and the Civil War ends. We're in the Reconstruction era. And there was this part of, you know, what I loved learning about was were some of these organizing efforts that I didn't have a deep knowledge about. I didn't realize how many strikes happened with black workers in the South in the wake of the Civil War during the during Reconstruction. Can you talk a little bit about that and those movements?
Yeah, there was, man, it was a really interesting period because, like, black workers were finally being paid for their labor, but they're still being treated terribly. And the cognitive dissonance there was like, well, this is, we're supposed to be free. We're supposed to be citizens. And you're still acting like we are exactly the same as we were subjugated to be right before emancipation. Like there were, you know, there's the big Atlanta strike or strike threat by washerwomen in 1881 that kind of shook the city and showed very clearly how much power is held by workers who are even in the most, you know, dirty and dangerous and least respected professions. As at a point where there was this great cotton exposition coming to town, and Southern businessmen were using that as a way to show Northerners with money, like, hey, you can invest in Atlanta, where this cosmopolitan growing industry, our workforce is docile, we can do whatever we want with them. Come on down, come be part of this. And a washerwoman who understood very clearly what was at stake and what the opportunity was there were like, well, you know what? There are a lot of hotels and a lot of guests and a lot of sheets that need to be cleaned. Wouldn't it be a shame if that didn't happen, if you didn't give in to our demands and pay us better and treat us better? And honestly, history is a little murky on what actually happened as a result of that. I would say to read Tara Hunter's book, To Join My Freedom, for like a deeper view of that particular action. But that this kind of set a precedent, right? And we saw this happening like in Galveston in Texas and just other areas around the South where black workers, and sometimes they're joined by white workers too, were rising up and were going on strike and were demanding better and demanding what they were due. And that was just such an incredibly brave and audacious thing to do during that period. And it's just, I mean, that legacy lives on. Like one of the like the huge through lines throughout my book is that, you know, black workers have been behind like every huge leap in progress for the labor movement, whether right. or not they show up on the posters.
Well, they were locked out of the National Labor Union and they formed their own. Can you talk about that and that division? Because, you know, that is an unfortunate consequence of you know, or it's an unfortunate dividing line, even though, and speaks to some of the behindness that you talk about there.
Yeah, I mean, for a really long time, unions were segregated or didn't even entertain the idea of allowing black members to join or women. But like, there's specific and very vicious discrimination against black workers. So black workers formed their own unions outside of that framework. I think one of the most impactful ones and like best known ones, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters led by A. Philip Randolph, like they were transformative. They were one of the first, I think the first black led union to be like recognized by the American Federation of Labor. They, I think, were one of the first to bargain like a massive contract with these huge, with like the Amazon of their day, like with the railroad barons. And that was like, it took a really long time for unions to kind of get with the program and integrate properly. Though there are also examples of earlier unions like Local 8 of the IWW, Industrial Works of the World, in Philadelphia. Ben Fletcher, a very impactful organizer for them, a black man from South Philly, he managed to organize an interracial union in 1910, and they ruled the Philly docks for like a decade and set a really cool precedent there. Like, there are people that were able to bridge these gaps, but it was rare up until, you know, the 60s and onward.
You mentioned the railroad monopolies, and that I think is an easy transition into the 20th century and when the economy collapses. What did that do for labor organizing, and what did that do for unionizing that you found in your research?
You mean in terms of just the Gilded Age or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the railroads, I mean, we saw 1877, the Great Railroad Strike, that was a massive action of workers across the country who were standing up against these rail barons and trying to get a decent wage. Not, again, not asking for very much. Workers are never asking for that much. And yet it's seen as this absolute affront to the people in charge. But, I mean, that was a huge strike. That was a really violent strike, I think. I'm trying to remember. It's a long book. I'm trying to remember exactly how it ended, but I'm pretty sure the U.S. government stepped in and were not on the worker side, we'll say. You can read more about that. But it was also really impactful because people were paying attention, right? I think it was Emma Goldman who was paying attention to that strike, and that's what radicalized her and led her off on her own path. Like, every big event like that, like, we read about it in history books, and we think about it as, like, you know, situated within history. But there are so many people who are living through these moments and watching these moments and learning from these moments. And so, like, I feel like there are a lot of direct lines that probably some smarter than me can draw from the Great Railroad Strike in 1977 to decades, if not centuries, more organizing after that.
I think the moment that most people think about when looking at a watershed moment for labor organizing is obviously the Triangle Fire. And you focus on that in the second chapter, I believe, of your book. Tenement living conditions in the Lower East Side were abysmal. The working conditions at factories like Triangle were also abysmal. And the response, both the lead up and unfortunately the vindication of these organizers when this fire happened and the aftermath, I think are important to remind people of, if you don't mind going through that history a bit.
Yeah, that's, I feel like, and I could be wrong, but I feel like the Triangle Factory Fire is one of the few big labor history touch points that a lot of people know about, but there's still so much that goes into that story. And even that goes into the people involved in that story, like Clara Lemlich, a Jewish Ukrainian immigrant who was one of the kind of the faces of the strike. She was, she helped organize it. And she's kind of built up into this sort of mythical, like, oh, she stood up in a meeting as this little woman and called a strike and people listened. She was an organizer. She was part of the uprising of the 20,000 2 years before. She got six of her ribs broken by police while she was out on the picket line. Like, none of these historical figures are just, you know, they're people, they're organizers. They put in the work. But just kind of the cliff notes for the fire itself. Like you said, this was not, again, this is a horrible work environment. It was full of cloth scraps and dust, poorly ventilated. The most important factor in this particular tragedy is that the bosses would lock the doors, lock workers in, because they're afraid that workers would steal from them, like take a couple scraps of cotton home, God forbid. And actually, speaking of the uprising of the 20,000, 2 years prior, the owners of the Triangle Factory, they were one of the only like garment factories in that area that refused to sign on to like a contract with the union that would have made working conditions better, would have made things safer. They dipped out. They're like, no. And as a result, 2 years later, when a fire broke out in that building, I think it was on the sixth floor, it, you know, people were trapped. They couldn't get out. People crushed into the elevator and that broke. And when I say people, I mean predominantly women and girls, like people as young as 14 were working in that factory that day. And it's just awful to think about, because there's 146 people that died. Most of them suffocated or burned to death. And others died on the concrete after jumping out of the windows in full view of onlookers. Like, this is a very public, visceral, like, sensory tragedy. And it's still one of the worst, you know, like, industrial incidents in, well, that's a really bloodless way to put it, worker tragedies in U.S. history. But it, the only, I don't want to say silver lining, the only positive thing that did come out of that was, like, this much, this heightened public awareness of those working conditions and fire safety. And the fact that Frances Perkins, who was then a young woman probably about our age, she happened to be in town, and she was already working for like the National Consumer Agency doing like consumer protection stuff. And she saw what happened, and that altered the trajectory of her life. She went on to spend the rest of her long career fighting for workers' rights, first in like local New York State politics and local commissions, and then as the first female Secretary of Labor. And during that, yeah, during her tenure there, she like was the architect of the New Deal. She's behind Social Security. She's like FDR. Like, if people lionize him, like, Frances Perkins is right up there. And it's all of that happened, like, good and bad, because a couple factory owners locked the doors to make sure their workers couldn't steal a couple scraps of cotton.
Right, and I mean, you mentioned how many, you know, the. These immigrants, workers working in these garment factories, like they were also many of them were Jewish, right? I mean, there was this in the cultural understanding of Triangle. It seems crazy to me, but the organizing part of it is not really front-facing enough. It's more just, this is a cautionary tale. This was capitalism run amok, if you're, you know. But the fact that there was organizing before and then, of course, after, and what it led to, I appreciated that focus that you drew there.
Right, because none of this just happens, like, well, sometimes things happen spontaneously, but most of the time, everything's built on years and years of work. Like, Claire Lemlich was out there in 1909 on the picket line with 20,000 other factory workers who are almost entirely Jewish, Eastern European women and Italian women. Like, they were fighting for a union. They were fighting for better working conditions and better wages. And, like, they shut down the city. And then 2 years later, this happened at a factory that had refused to sign on and acknowledge the union, acknowledge their organized. Like, that is very significant. Like, it's, I think when we're reading about history and these big kind of evocative historical events, there's an impulse to kind of reduce people to caricatures in a good or a bad way. Like, oh, this brave girl showed up in a meeting and then everyone went on strike and it was glorious. Like, no, there are a lot of meetings and the cops were trying to beat them up. And like, it's nothing. There's always a bigger story, right? And that was what I was hoping to do in this book, kind of find the stories beneath the surface to show, like, how these things happened, not just be excited or be sad that they did happen.
Right. Can you, you talked a bit about Frances Perkins, but do you mind expanding on her role? Because I think she's an immensely important historical figure for people to understand. You mentioned her role in shaping Social Security, her time in FDR's cabinet. But, you know, she first was working, pressuring politicians in New York State politics, and I think she's kind of a rare case of an organizer getting elevated to that kind of position. I mean, we don't necessarily. Howard Schultz is in the news, and he was being considered for Labor Secretary at a certain point. I remember, and so that's real. Bradley, just make sure I'm right about that. Howard Schultz is being considered for Labor Secretary, right?
Like, yeah, that was a Hillary thing. It came out, and people were like, oh, okay, Starbucks guy. And then the discourse kicked back in. You're like, can you imagine that guy?
Right? So contrast that with Frances Perkins. I mean, that is, you know, there's a similar kind of reckoning happening right now, and you can draw parallels to the Gilded Age, and we're in this like bloated period in American history, and there's got to be something that has to give. But the fact that FDR rewarded her with this position and she made such an impact, that's important to understand, I think, as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only was she the first female labor secretary, she was the first female cabinet secretary. And that was, like, I think she was elected or installed in, like, 1933, which was still not the most enlightened age, right? Especially, like, to elevate a woman to the highest level of government. And I remember I read a really great biography of her that I can't remember the name of because I have thick brain fog, but people should look up biographies of her because she's just so interesting. But she, I mean, she didn't, like, spring fully formed from Zeus's forehead either as a worker advocate. Even when she had witnessed the Triangle Fire, like, she was already on a path to advocate for workers. She just hadn't quite found it yet, right? But, and she ended up on these safety commissions, specifically fire safety commissions. And she just worked her way up, like, as kind of a true believer and found her way up to the highest point of government, which is, again, not something that happens to organizers, to people that really care, the people that care more about the people than their own aspirations. And once she got in there, like, she took some pretty unpopular stances that were very much in line with her own values. Like, I think one of the first, I found this tidbit, one of the first actions she took was to desegregate the Department of Labor's cafeteria in, like, the 1930s, which is way before that was happening on a national scale, right? Like, she was down. One of the major, one of her other big accomplishments, I guess I would say, is that during World War II, or I think even before World War II, when Hitler was just coming to power, she stood up and basically helped rescue, like, hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees who were trying to escape that regime before World War I. It's just really gratifying to read more about her and learn more about her and be able to kind of find a little bit more about a person that we know, yes, labor secretary, we know Social Security, like, the person behind it, like, what was driving her, what made her do this, what allowed her to get to this point where she could do this. Like, yeah, having organizers in office, turns out, is a pretty good thing for workers.
Yeah.
And it would be nice that that was take a lesson from 1933, at least in one way, and maybe bring that vibe back, you know?
Would be nice. Stark contrast with Obama getting a list from Citigroup and then stacking his cabinet with those same people. But, you know, hopefully things are changing. I mean, Biden, not to get too much into the present, at least rhetorically, he seems to understand the value of being pro-labor. Now, does that translate into advocating for the PRO Act to the degree that he should? No, but it seems like the NLRB, and not just seems like, it's been a marked improvement from past administrations, Democratic, you know, Clinton and Obama, and of course, Republican administrations.
You know, I'm excited about the NLRB. It's such a funny thing to explain to people that aren't giant nerds about this stuff. Like, well, there's this government agency called the National Labor Relations Board that's actually pretty cool right now. They, like, got some teeth. Like, the general counsel is sending out these memos that are really dope. And people are like, what?
Yeah.
Like, no, trust me, it's cool. Like, Jennifer Brewster's out here talking about getting rid of captive audience meetings. She's talking about Joy Silk. Like, we're in a really, as depressing as it can be to think about the modern labor movement and the numbers and union density and everything that's stacked up against us, like, we got to take the wins where we get them. Because, like, if you don't have hope, you don't got nothing. And I, at the very least, Jennifer Abruzzo and the folks at the NLRB give me a little bit of hope that I didn't have before. And, like, I'll take it. Given how things have gone for labor in this country, like, I'll take it for now. Let's see what they do. But it's nice to have a little ray of optimism, you know?
100%. And I want to, we'll talk a bit, we'll end really on where we are today, but I wanted to touch on a few more stories before we get to that. Because at the same time as Triangle is happening, that organizing in New York, across the country, there are Chinese workers in San Francisco also organizing. And they're completely, I think, you know, left out of the dominant historical narrative about some of these things. Can you talk about their efforts?
I would ask you to be a little bit more specific, just because it's a very long book, and I'm trying to remember what specific incident you might be referring to.
See, you know, if my notes were more specific, I could probably help you with that. but I guess maybe just, like, the larger dynamic of what was happening on the West Coast, if you can talk broadly about it.
Okay, because there's, well, the West Coast is really an epicenter for organizing for a really long time, specifically with Chinese workers and workers from other Asian countries. And honestly, one of the things in the book that made me the angriest to write about, and I think is worth mentioning because I don't know if people necessarily know about this, is the amount of support that the American Federation of Labor and a lot of labor leaders in the 1800s, a lot of the support they had for the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was 1882, and it barred Chinese workers from coming to this country, using that same, like I'm trying not to curse, that same xenophobic rhetoric that has impacted so many other types of workers over the years. And it had a really interesting ripple effect. Like, we're talking about organizing. It's a little later than 1911, but 1946, in Hawaii, Chinese workers, as well as Korean and Japanese and Filipino and Puerto Rican, just like this massive mishmash of different cultures and ethnicities in Hawaii who were working on these sugarcane plantations. That
was what I wanted to get to next. Yes, that's a specific one, right?
Yeah, because there's so much in here, right? Like, it went through 300 years of history. But that's an example that stands out to me, right? Because that it shows the power of interracial, multilingual, multigender organizing at a point where the government and the bosses were actively trying to keep workers apart. That the point, the Chinese workers who ended up in Hawaii to work on these plantations after the native Hawaiians had basically shown that they were not interested in dealing with those conditions and those, just the framework that the colonizers had set up. They were like, no, hard pass on this. So the plantation owners started luring Chinese workers to work there. And then when they felt like there were too many Chinese workers, they started luring Japanese and Korean, like mixing it up. Like they just kept bringing in new groups of people and hoping that they wouldn't organize, that they would, if they treated them differently, if they paid them differently, it would keep them apart in a way that benefited the bosses. And in 1946, at a point where a lot of those workers were members of the ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, they decided to go on strike. And the way they won was by sitting down and being like, okay, they're trying to keep us apart. We're living in different camps. Like, Chinese workers live here. Korean workers live here. We're paid differently. We're treated differently. We need to bring people together. We need to show that we're in this, we're all in one struggle. Like, we need to show up with translators. We need to set up strike kitchens. We need to meet people on a human level and show that, you know, the bosses aren't going to treat, they don't care about any of us. And in order to make things better for everyone, we need to stand together. And that's what they did. And they won. And it was just such a great precedent to set. And that's, again, the power of multiracial, multigender organizing, where, like, you meet people where they are and realize the differences are actually strengths.
I mean, and especially the sugar barons that were trying to separate these workers and keep them down. You see how capitalism intersects with colonialism, particularly in those instances, and how many and how workers' interests are on the opposing side of that, even though sometimes that distinction can get muddied a little bit, I think.
You mean the, like, labor against capital, the great class war?
sometimes, yeah. It can get obscured, but that really is... that's what it comes down to. And before we get to the present day, let's just talk about one more example, the Latina janitors in California. That was another thing that struck me. Do you mind telling that story as well?
Yeah. Oh, I love them. They're so, it's just such a wonderful example of, like, worker to worker organizing, how we protect ourselves, right? But we're talking about the Yabasta campaign that happened. I think it was fairly recent, actually. Janitors in California, predominantly Latina women, were enduring really just horrific conditions on the job, specifically in regards to sexual assault and sexual violence that they faced, especially on the night shift. There was a PBS documentary called Rape on the Night Shift that helped really illuminate that whole, like, horrible state of affairs. And when the women came to their union and showed them, like, hey, this is what we've been dealing with, like, what are you going to do about it? The union actually listened and was like, okay, we failed you. We're really sorry. We're going to listen to what you want to do, because the most of the leadership were men, and they weren't thinking about the specific risks that women faced on the job. They weren't thinking about, you know, specific accommodations or protections that women might need because they're dudes. They weren't thinking about it. And then they were forced to think about it. And the women stood up, were like, you know, we need to do something. Like, what are you going to do to protect us? And they launched this whole campaign called Yabasta, which it's kind of, it's, and it's still going. It's kind of morphed into this whole community effort where, like worker organizers train other worker organizers to like, they call them promotoras, to educate and advocate and basically just teach other workers how to protect themselves, how to watch out for these things, how to work with the union. It's just really, I don't want to say inspiring because it's still a difficult struggle, but it's really wonderful to see these workers who are obviously very marginalized, who are dealing with insurmountable odds, take power into their own hands and build up something that protects themselves, like without, like they did it themselves, like worker to worker. I think that's the most effective way to do anything, right? Like, again, finding common ground, standing up for your people, and showing that you are not someone to be trifled with.
Right. It's why, like, you have the leaked reporting about Amazon trying to ban words like, I think Solidarity was in it, or Union in their company chat. I mean, that was Ken Klippenstein of The Intercept. The division is beneficial for capitalists. And let's now just talk about what we're seeing today. You know, the pandemic really laid bare how horrible conditions have been en masse for workers. Millions of Americans quit their job. It's been called the Great Resignation. And also it's coincided with, and I don't think it's a coincidence, this surge in organizing and this also larger pro-union perspective in the United States. Sentiment is high and it's... unions are more popular than they've been in many decades. And so, I think that there's a collective consciousness or elevation about the value of one's labor. And do you mind just talking about that dynamic? I'm sure you're working on this book for a long time. Seeing it evolve in real time as you research this history must have been a really unique experience.
Yeah, it was. I'm not on mute, am I?
No.
Okay. It's a wacky program. It was wild, but it was really interesting to see all these things unfolding kind of around me and in my own home, because my partner, like he's an essential worker. He's been out there the whole time. He worked on a farm. He worked at a grocery store at the height of the pandemic, and he works on another farm now. And just thinking about all the people that couldn't stay home, like it's very personal. And then just in general, seeing this discourse around essential work for the first time in maybe ever. We had major media outlets running stories about, you know, thanking healthcare workers and thanking sanitation workers. And like we had the pots and pans in New York. Some people got hazard pay or got COVID raises, like for a little bit of time. And then that all went away. Like my boyfriend's paycheck went right back to where it was. A lot of other people's paychecks went back to where they were. And it was as if, you know, the rest of the world had moved on while everyone still had to go to work and still had to risk their lives. And I think there was a big shift there in folks, in workers' understanding of like, or really their own conception of the value of their lives and their labor. And this realization that like, oh, we keep everything running. They're saying we're essential. So why aren't we being treated that way? And I think that's a really important kind of light bulb to go off. I think, and we had that brief moment where the government gave us a little bit of money to try and get through this nightmare. And that gave some people a little bit of a cushion where they could think like, maybe I can quit my awful job. Maybe I can find something better. Maybe I can, you know, whether you call it the Great Resignation or just take this job and shove it, like 2021 edition. Like there are a couple different factors that gave people a little bit of room and a little bit of a mental shift. And I think that's led directly into these massive strikes we saw. And it killed me to be home in my little office writing my book while Striketober hit and sort of Strikevember, like all these massive worker actions that were getting so much attention. And I think showing people in a very big way that like, oh yeah, unions are still around. Strikes are still an option. This is something that you could do. And we're seeing that play out now with Amazon, with Starbucks, these like household brands that everyone knows are owned by these just insanely rich, weird space freaks. And the fact that people are standing up against them and winning, that is huge. I mean, the fact that we're seeing this, I can't remember the exact, I wrote it down. There's a big strike that just kicked off in the Midwest with the UAW, the CNH, CNH industrial plants in Wisconsin and Iowa. That's the United Auto Workers. That's like a traditional manufacturing labor union, right? And they're out on this giant strike while people are talking about Starbucks, while grad students at Kenyon and Grinnell are on strike. Like, I think we're in a moment where a lot of different workers and a lot of different industries are realizing, like, oh, we have a little bit more power than we thought we did. Maybe we should do something about that, because like the world is on fire. No one's looking out for us but our neighbors and our coworkers. So maybe it's time to take some steps.
And last question, just about the concept of gig work, and you know, we're seeing an increase in gig workers. Do you think that also accelerated some of this, because there's, you know, this complete exploitation by major companies and other companies? We don't have to provide you with protection. You're just a gig worker. You're just a contractor, except you're working full time for us. That's another dynamic that I think is deeply concerning, but also galvanizing.
Yeah, because so many of those workers are the ones who are sacrificing the most, like delivery workers, Instacart shoppers, like all the people that made this world keep turning. Most of them don't have a W-2. Most of them don't have benefits. Most of them don't have a decent hourly wage. Like, the rise of gig work or app-based whatever, like, there's a lot of different names for it. But it's all just a horrible technologically assisted update of what people are dealing with in the early 20th century with piecework, where garment workers would take home a couple extra shirt collars or shirt waist to work on by candlelight in their little cramped tenement apartment, and make a couple extra bucks and bring that home. Like, paying workers by the piece, also a historical precedent, also a terrible historical precedent. Like, it's very obvious that someone who drives for Uber works for Uber. And all of these, like, sort of diabolical machinations on the company's part and the legislation they've pushed to try and separate that very simple fact from reality. It's like, I mean, I'm glad that there are gig workers organizing. I'm glad there's the Gig Workers Collective. I'm glad that, you know, the New York Taxi Works Association has brought in Uber and Lyft drivers. Like, we need to, even though our labor laws aren't built for them yet, we need to make sure the labor movement is embracing and advocating for gig workers, because that's, whether we like it or not, that's probably a big chunk of the future. I mean, I'm an independent contractor. I'm basically a gig worker. It sucks. So, like, the future is as bright as we make it. And I think doubling down on showing solidarity with the most vulnerable workers, the most exploited workers, is the only way we're going to accomplish anything worth a damn.
Kim Kelly, journalist, organizer, and author of Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Solidarity forever.
Yes, solidarity forever. With that said, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Jessica Cisneros, running in Texas's 28th district. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined once again by Jessica Cisneros, running in Texas's 28th district as a progressive in a runoff that is approaching soon. Jessica, thanks so much for being here today.
Of course. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be back.
Yes, happy to have you. Your race is, I think, arguably the most important this year because of many things, right? I mean, Henry Cuellar, FBI looking into him for corruption issues. That was already should have been a massive strike against him. But now we're in this moment where Roe v. Wade is on life support. It's likely if Alito's decision, opinion stands and the conservative justices join him, that Roe v. Wade will be overturned in the next few weeks. And you are running against Henry Cuellar, who, as I mentioned, has these corruption issues, but also is the lone anti-abortion Democrat in Congress. This has got to be, at the forefront of the difference between the two of you. Do you mind responding a bit to the reports coming out of Politico about where the Supreme Court is going and how that fits into your race?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I had been bracing myself for quite some time. I have a few colleagues, friends who, do repro rights work here in Texas. And, even though after speaking to them, this was probably a likely scenario that the Supreme Court was going to rule in the summer and overturn Roe and Casey. I mean, it's just something completely different just watching it happen, right? Like we are literally watching the fall of Roe, the erosion of our fundamental freedoms. And it's even more frustrating to know that after the Texas abortion ban was implemented last fall here in Texas, and then the House voted in response to that on the Women's Health Protection Act, Henry Cuellar was the only vote to side with Republicans and vote against codifying Roe. And I'm sure right now he's happy about all, what his role in basically eroding and leading to this point where we are seeing this very direct attack on our fundamental freedoms. And I think that this moment just really highlights the urgency and that we need a champion here who's going to fight for our rights in this district. And for us, that means winning on May 24th. The implications of this race truly go beyond South Texas. The last thing we want is to hold on to a slim Democratic majority and Henry Cuellar becomes the deciding vote, right, on our fundamental freedoms in this country, on our reproductive rights and the future of reproductive rights in this country. He could become a Joe Manchin of the House. And we just not, we can't risk that.
Absolutely not. Talk a little bit about how the outcome will affect Texas and your potential constituents and your neighbors, because Texas, it was really the first state to get this going. And right. And so you're already, I'm sure, feeling the ramifications and your constituents are. What's it been like as you've been on the campaign trail talking to women in particular about the outcome here?
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that we've been talking about since 2019 when I first decided to run, because we knew, Texas being, especially with the leadership that we have right now under Greg Abbott, and then the bills that were passed last summer during the Texas legislative session, we knew that we had to prepare. And I think part of the reason why processing this week and this news has been incredibly difficult is because it hits really close to home. I'm sure many of y'all heard a few weeks ago about the arrest of the young woman who went to the hospital. It happened here in Starr. She was trying to, provide a self-induced abortion to herself. And she was prosecuted because of that. She spent a night in jail. She spent time in jail. And it's the reason why I'm saying I'm bracing myself for this is because we know what's going to happen. And unfortunately, if, this decision does come to pass and we have people like Henry Cuellar who are anti-choice and are going to do everything they can to prevent us from having access to health care, which includes abortion care, I mean, we're just going to be seeing a lot more of what we saw a few weeks ago here in Starr County.
So what's your response to number three Democrat in the House, Clyburn, Nancy Pelosi endorsing your opponent, despite this? I mean, Clyburn had a quote about how we have a big tent party. If we're going to be a big tent party, we've got to be a big tent party, he said to reporters. But that tent doesn't seem to include progressives. I mean, it's understandable if you're in a power position in the Democratic Party, you need to support your incumbents. That's what they feel. But there has to be, as my producer Matt said earlier, a point where you cut bait. And I don't understand why an incumbent with an FBI investigation into him and who is anti-choice, anti-abortion, is somebody that deserves protection. I mean, it is absolutely flabbergasting to me.
I mean, I also agree, right? And especially here, I mean, it can't be because Henry Cuellar supports, you know, key Democratic proposals and legislation because he's actively been working against it. I mean, other than that, the only thing I can think of is the fact that he's an incumbent and that's it, right? But the thing that I've been trying to highlight with this is the fact that, one, during the March 1st primary election, over half of the voters voted for a pro-choice candidate. South Texas wants pro-choice representation. And I really want Democratic leadership to know that I'm ready to work and to deliver on the Democratic priorities that Henry Cuellar has been an obstacle to, right? Like right now, this week, I really want folks to know that this isn't a drill, right? Our fundamental freedoms are on the line and we need to pull out all the stops to fight for our rights. And we just cannot risk Henry Cuellar being a determining vote on the future of so many rights in this country.
It seems incredibly risky. And I wonder what some of the people you've spoken to in your district, or potential district, I should say, have said about his position on this. Is it well advertised that he is anti-abortion? Because it seems like he's made some sort of calculation. But frankly, abortion rights and Roe v. Wade in particular, it's popular in the country. It's popular in your district. It's popular in the country. And yet, I don't understand how if there has to be a line that in the Democratic Party, how is this not the line? I mean, I'm outraged by it, but obviously as women, I know that it's just like, it's personal to us. And so I'm immensely frustrated by it.
I know, me too. And I mean, people here, the folks that we've spoken to, it's definitely something that we're hearing in our voter interactions, whether it be on the phone or on, you know, at the doors. I do remember, for example, when Wade voted against the Women's Health Protection Act, we didn't time this that way. It just so happened that we had a phone bank that weekend after the vote. And the first calls that I had were women that I spoke to that are from the district that were saying, they were telling me that they were upset that Henry Cuellar voted against the Women's Health Protection Act, which is, I mean, good news because it's, people are paying attention, right? Like this primary since last cycle has really put the onus on Henry Cuellar to try to explain himself and his track record because he had been, you know, he had gone without being held accountable for a very long time until we decided to step up and challenge him and make him answer for all of these terrible votes, not just being anti-choice, but being, you know, anti-worker, you know, voting to fund the border wall twice, being anti-immigrant. Like there's just so many issues where clearly, he is not in line with the values of our district.
Lastly, you mentioned on the 24th May, that's when your runoff is. How are you feeling? What are some of the issues that you're, besides, of course, these obvious distinctions between yourself and your opponent, what are some of the issues that you've been emphasizing with voters? I know you're for Medicare for All, for a Green New Deal. What has been resonating with people and what have been some of your points of emphasis as the date approaches of the runoff election?
Yeah, I mean, this is a district where, for example, my hometown would have 30% poverty rate before the pandemic. One in four people were uninsured. Medicare for All and a $15 minimum wage are key points in, you know, running and getting this victory on May 24th. We really need all the help we can get. We're 19 days away now from the election. We have a lot to celebrate on May 24th, and I want to make sure that one of the things that we celebrate is that we win. The other thing is that I'm turning 29 that day.
Oh, so, congrats.
It's going to be a crazy day, but, you know, I I can't think of a better way to spend it than being out there trying to work alongside so many people and create change down here in South Texas. That's what I want as my birthday wish.
Oh my gosh. I mean, come on. You can't lose on your birthday. We can't allow this to happen. So where can people find out more about your campaign and help out, even if, you know, they're not in your district?
Yeah, you can go to JessicaCisneros.com or JessicaCisnerosForCongress.com. Either works. My last name is CISNEROS. We need people to chip in to help us on our phone banks. If you are in Texas and in the district, we need you knocking on doors. We need all the help we can get. Like, we're trying to really amplify this race, especially in light of the news from this week, because this is, you know, I mean, our race is in 19 days. And if we can ensure that we kick out the last anti-choice Democrat in Congress, that's going to set the tone for the rest of the midterm elections this year.
100%. This is a really important race. Jessica Cisneros, we will put the link to all of that in our description and in the show notes and the podcast description as well. Thanks so much, Jessica. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Emma. Take care.
Take care. With that said, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, Matt, what happened on Left Reckoning last night?
Yeah, last night people want to check it out. I think a lot of people were using the word inspired in the comment section. We had Robin Wansley on, who's an independent socialist city council member from Ward 2 in Minneapolis, and we talked about why she decided to run, why being independent of the Democratic Party is allowing her a little bit more freedom to say call out Mayor Jacob Fry, and I think like if you there's a lot of like, you know, theorizing and hypotheticals when it comes to like, can we win with the Democratic Party, or can we win outside of it? And for me personally, it's like, I like our DSA members who have like this sort of dual endorsement with Democratic parties. I think they get stuff done. They're much better, much better, I should say, than even like standard progressive Democrat. Independent socialist is an entire different thing, and building that sort of power up is I think going to be really important. So check out our interview last night with Robin Wansley. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, it sounds great. I gotta check that out, because you said it's a best of. So.
Oh yeah, it'll be best of 2022.
Awesome. All right. Do we have Brandon and Binder?
Might need to wait for those guys.
Okay. Well, you know, we'll just check out Doomed, check out Scam Economy, check out the discourse. Great stuff. With that, we're going to head into the fun half.
Reminder about the link.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a new link.
So there's a fun half link you'll find in the description. And also, we should be redirected automatically. To
if you have autoplay on.
The new fun half link. Oh, you need autoplay. Interesting.
Yeah, I think so, right?
Possibly. I haven't seen it from the opposite side yet, but... yeah, so we're going to switch over in the course of this fun half. So click that link, folks.
646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Boom.
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it! Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
If it's me, hello, is this me?
Think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. what's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for a
walk. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.